Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have with us today a special guest, Michelle May O'Neill from Dallas. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks, guys, for having me.
Anybody who is in the appellate world, I'm sure, has heard of you or is aware of you in large part because you're so visible. Why don't you tell us a little bit, though, about your background and what led you to your current practice?
So I've been a lawyer for 28 years. I'm a Baylor grad. You know, whenever I graduated from law school, I was 23. I went through Baylor on the 3-3 program, but I did it in 2.5 and 2.5. For some reason, I was in a super big hurry to get out of school. I kind of regret that, by the way. But, you know, in law school, I wasn't a good student. I kind of brought up the rear so that there was a top of the class, because you got to have a bottom to have a top. So I brought up the rear. But the only thing I really excelled at, the thing I made the high A in, was legal writing. And so as time went along, you know, whenever I got out of the law school, the economy was terrible. We were in a huge recession way back then, and lawyers were getting laid off right and left and everything. So I started my own firm. And when I first started, I had just barely turned 24. And
wow. Yeah,
and started my own firm, hung out a shingle, signed a lease, and bought a computer. You know, back then computers were way different than they are now, and signed up on the court appointed list. And I had a real experienced paralegal in Bell County named Tudor Porter. And she worked for one of the big criminal defense lawyers in town. And she taught me how to go to the jail and how to negotiate a plea deal with the DA's office. And I did a lot of juvenile crime because, of course, I was 24 and I probably looked about 12. And so I still could speak young people. Like, I can't speak young people now, but back then I could kind of explain like the Constitution to a 12-year-old in language they would understand. So I did a lot of juvenile crime defense. But the only thing that would actually hire me was family law. I remember the first day whenever I was just barely opened my practice, this guy walked in on a Friday afternoon, no appointment, total walk-in, and he had three $100 bills. And he wanted me to write a letter about his child support to his ex's lawyer or whatever. And they were threatening him about something. It was one of those things, I don't even remember the facts of what it was now, but at the time, it was like, hey, I know the answer to this. I know what to do about this. And so I took his $300 and I wrote a letter and exchanged a couple letters with this lawyer and like solved his problem. And so after that, I was like, hey, you know, this is something that, you know, might actually pay me money to do, because I looked so young and being female, you know, and being in solo practice, you know, there was only so much business coming in my door. So, you know, between court-appointed criminal defense and then family law, I mean, that's really where I got my start. And at some point in that process, you know, the hiring work took over the court-appointed work, and I got to stop doing the court-appointed work. So family law just became my life.
Sounds like family law kind of chose you.
That's exactly how I say it. Whenever people ask me how I got into family law, I say family law chose me. I don't know that I was in law school at Baylor sitting around thinking, you know, yay, I'm going to go divorce people for a living. But that's how it ended up.
Wow. So you've been involved, I think you've been in some different firm practice settings. You mentioned you started off as a solo, and then if I remember correctly, you kind of built up from there and then maybe went into another firm, and then now you're sort of back in your own driver's seat, so to speak.
So, yeah. So I started out in Bell County on my own, and I practiced there for about 5.5 years. Got enough to sit for board certification, jury trials and stuff like that. And I just kind of decided one day, like, do I want to be the fish in the small pond or do I want to go look for something more? And I got offered a job in Dallas, not in family law. And so I took that. I was doing car wreck defense cases, insurance defense. And I was like, this is like the same car wreck case, the same sprain strain every day. And I just, that wasn't doing it for me. I missed the excitement of family law. So at that point, I got hired by, at the time, McCurley Kinzer, McCurley and Nelson, which then became McCurley Orsinger. And now it's Orsinger Nelson Downing. So I had the honor and the privilege of being trained as a family lawyer by Mike McCurley, Kathy Kinzer, and then in appellate world by Richard Orsinger. Wow. And that pedigree for me was just invaluable. I mean, you know, Mike McCurley in particular and Richard as it relates to appellate world, like I would not be the lawyer I am today if it weren't for the experience I had working for them. You know, mm-hmm. And there were good days and bad days as there are at any firm. But, you know, just being able to listen to Richard Orsinger talk about strategies of how to craft a petition for review to the Texas Supreme Court, you know, how he approaches argument. Like, people don't get that. Like in CLE, he doesn't share that kind of stuff. You know, I remember there was one case where we had, it was a huge case out of Tyler, I think. And big divorce case, and it was set for trial, and Richard was handling the appellate issues, and I was assigned to draft Mike McCurley's voir dire. And we had this retreat over a weekend, which sounds really fun, going down to the Hill Country to Kerrville and having a retreat. But now I understand it was really designed just to maximize our billable hours on this one case, getting us ready for trial. And so I spent an entire weekend in meetings with Mike and Richard, like preparing a voir dire. And I learned so much in that about strategies of voir dire, about trilogies and looping and all these things of how to win a case in voir dire. And, you know, it was just things like that that were just so invaluable that made me a great trial lawyer and that have made me a great appellate lawyer over the years of having that experience. So then I, after several years in that firm, I decided that I wanted to be back out on my own. I started on my own, went to basically McCurley, and then decided to go back out on my own. So I started a solo practice and did that for, I don't know, 11, 12 years, something like that, and got a little bit frustrated with that. You know, in solo practice, you feel like you're Atlas with the weight of the world on your shoulders. And so I closed my solo practice and went to work for Godwin in Dallas, which is also a very infamous firm. And I stayed there about 10 months, maybe 11. So there was some over-unders on how long that I would last in that. And so I made it about 10 or 11 months. And then some things kind of shifted with the firm and some things shifted with me. And I met Michael Wysocki. I'd had a case against Michael Wysocki, a trial court case, a couple of years prior. And he and I fought like dogs and I won. That's a very important part of the story, by the way, that I won.
Sensing a theme.
Yeah, no, I beat him. And it was a hard fought, stressful situation, you know, but then he was unhappy. He was at McCurley at that point, but Mike had just retired. Mike McCurley had just retired. And so that firm was in a big shift also. And he was wanting something more from his practice. So we had coffee and had a few quote date, professional date, and decided that we approached life in a very similar way. And we wanted to see what we could do together. So that's been 5 years ago,
wow.
5 years ago this summer that we started O'Neill Wysocki. I still do trial work. I think I'm pretty unique as an appellate lawyer that I'd still do both. So I do trial work. I head the appellate efforts for the firm. You know, I oversee strategy on cases. You know, I help our young lawyers know how to preserve error and file summary judgments and, you know, all of that. But the funnest part of our current practice is when Michael and I get to try a jury trial together. That's a lot of fun. So our styles are very, very different.
Well, I can't let it go by without mentioning how much I like your branding.
Thank you.
The owl, you know, O'Neill Wysocki lawyers with the image of the owl, you know, the wise choice, I think it
yes.
is.
Yes.
It's brilliant.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, most of that was Michael. I mean, I like doing marketing and I do plenty of it and I've done plenty of it for years, you know, with my own blog and everything. But whenever we were designing the firm, our logo design lady emailed me one day and she's like, "Hey, do you have the domain owlawyers.com?" And I'm like, "No, why?" And she's like, "OWL." You know, she had to spell it out for me. I'm like, "Oh my gosh, that's brilliant." And I called Michael. I'm like, "Okay, is this cheesy or is it brilliant?" And he's like, it's brilliant. And so when he and she were collaborating on the design of our logo, she had kind of an ornateness to it. And he's like, no, simple this down, make it into a pencil thing, put the owl, and then it's an O, and then the W's kind of hidden up in the owl wing. And it was the owl firm from there. I mean, we're known. I get Facebook posts almost every week with somebody posting, I saw an owl and thought of Michelle, or, you know, so everybody gives me owl presents, and I showed y'all my owl house slippers a minute ago. So yeah, I mean, you know, it's become quite the thing. So Michael gets credit for that.
That's very cool. And I know you're also kind of involved in social media, and you were telling us you moderate a Facebook group, Women Lawyers. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Tracy Ahart and I founded a group called #HellOnHeels on Facebook. And we now have about 1,300, mostly Texas women lawyers, a few from out of state, a few non-lawyers, but mostly Texas women lawyers. And our group is aimed at, of course, heels. Hell on Heels. So we talk a lot about shoes, but a lot about positivity. We don't talk cases in our group because we do have some judges that are members, several Court of Appeals justices. And so we've outlawed case discussions so that we don't influence our judges. But we talk about issues that are relevant to women lawyers and, you know, keep it positive.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge. Well, you are unique in terms of the blend of your practice area. I don't know too many. I mean, you mentioned Richard Orsinger, of course, and he's very well known as a family lawyer, appellate lawyer. I know one or two others, but not many, really, who specialize in family law appeals.
Right.
And then it seems like most that I know do something like what you do, which is they will maintain a trial practice too.
Yeah.
You know, this is the Texas Appellate Law Podcast.
Yeah.
And so the trial practice part is really interesting and important, but I want to really ask you about your appellate, not only your appellate experience, but just the appellate component of your practice, because I know what I do, and I am not an expert in family law. And to me, it's, you know, gosh, it's kind of intimidating, if anything, because I'm worried if I get into it and I don't feel like I know what I'm doing, that I'm going to really screw something up.
Hey, that's all right. You can send them all to me.
Well, I mean, how are family law appeals different than ordinary appeals?
So our standard of review is a little bit different and a lot looser than what y'all experience most of the time in civil world. Standard of review generally is abuse of discretion. Most of our trials happen as bench trials. And so, you know, where in civil world, most of the, you know, final trials would be jury trials. And so you would have sufficiency analysis as part of your jury trial. And then you also have a requirement of motion for new trial to preserve error. In family law, where we have mostly bench trials, the abuse of discretion standard subsumes the sufficiency standard and broadens it. And then we don't have to mandatory file motions for new trial to preserve error. Now, obviously, if you have a jury trial in family law, then that changes back to some of the civil standards that y'all are familiar with. You know, interestingly, Texas is the only state in the country that allows jury trials in family law cases.
Really?
So that makes it even more unique as to my practice, because our firm and Michael and I try so many jury trials, but that's a very, very unique little thing, that to try jury trials and then know how to appeal a family law jury trial, because it kind of flips back to some of those standards that y'all are familiar with in civil world. Mm-hmm. There's also a difference in the findings of fact. So, you know, we know that there's the general findings of fact in the rules of civil procedure, but there's a couple of places in the family code that have specialized findings of fact that you can request and must request to preserve error. So, for example, if you're appealing a property division in a divorce, you have to request specifically the Chapter 6 specialized findings on valuations in order to prove an abuse of discretion in the overall division of the estate. And then you also, if there's a non-standard possession schedule, there's some specialized findings. There's some specialized findings in child support. And there used to be different deadlines for requesting all those. So it was even worse, but they've kind of stabilized that. Now, I had an appeal at one point that was PET denied by the Supreme Court, but we won at the Court of Appeals level. First case of first impression, upholding a trial court setting aside of a premarital agreement. Very, 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 very few of those cases in general in Texas, because there's such a presumption in favor of premarital agreements, and then even fewer that go up on appeal. But we had won at the Court of Appeals level, upholding the trial court setting aside this prenup, and PET denied at Supreme Court. But the other attorney on the other side was a well-known civil appellate lawyer, and they didn't request their findings on the property division. It was a property division appeal. And so, you know, what appellate lawyer's worst nightmare, right? Mm-hmm. The Court of Appeals opinion says, you know, waived error because you didn't request the right findings of fact. I mean, that's a nightmare, but that's an example of why a general civil appellate lawyer might not want to dabble in family law if you're not super familiar mm-hmm. with it.
Right.
And there's a lot of family law trial attorneys that don't know how to properly request findings of fact. I mean, you don't know how many appeals that I've had to tell the client, like, look, I'm sorry, but your chances of winning an appeal are even slimmer than they would otherwise be because your time for requesting the findings of fact has passed and we didn't request the specialized property valuation finding. And so we're not going to really be able to show reversible error in the overall division because of that. I mean, it makes me sad and annoyed, you know, that people don't get appellate lawyers involved sooner in the process or consult or even just read an article I've written. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been writing on the different standards and the differences in family law appeals for 20 years. I think I had an article in the appellate section newsletter like 20 years ago on the different standards of review. So, you know, it's not hard to learn, but as a trial lawyer, if you don't do appellate work, you know, that 20 days after judgment, I mean, you can really mess some things up, you know?
That abuse of discretion standard tends to be tough. You know, I know you mentioned that legal sufficiency is folded into it, and I've always thought that was a very interesting analytical framework.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and it affects remedies, right? Because in family law, we mostly have remand. We have very few renders. I've got one right now on a child support issue that I think I'm going to file a motion for. In fact, it's due next week. I've got to write a motion for rehearing on a remedy question where they reverse the judgment of the trial court on abuse of discretion on sufficiency of the evidence at trial. And they've remanded it for new trial. And I'm like, wait, this ought to be a render. They also offered remittiture. And I'm like, really?
In a family law case?
Yes. Yes. It was an attorney's fee question where they flat out didn't meet Rormus at all. But they proved up like a smidge of attorney's fees is what the court found, but not the full amount of the judgment. And so the court offered remittiture to the smidge. The other side said, no, we don't want remittiture. We want remand. So now they've remanded it. And I'm like, wait a minute. If it's legal sufficiency, it should be a render.
Ooh.
So anyway, in the middle of writing on that right now.
That's a fun one.
Yeah. But that's another example like of how family law appeals are just different. Our remedies mostly result in back in the same trial judge's lap that you weren't happy with in the first place.
It seems like there's a lot more opportunity for mandamus too, because so many things happen in the temporary orders that don't happen in civil cases that are, you know, not appealable other than maybe a receivership.
Yeah, I think there's more opportunity now than there ever has been for mandamus because, I mean, a few years ago, they started lightening the standards for mandamus. And then I was telling y'all my case that just came out, I think even further kind of lightened the standards for mandamus. But we don't have interlocutory appeals for the most part. There's only one time in family law that you have interlocutory appeals, and that's an opportunity for interlocutory appeal, and that's when a receiver is appointed. But otherwise, we don't have interlocutory appeals like y'all do in civil world. So mandamus is the only real remedy for a lot of the interim orders. And it used to be that the standards were so loosey-goosey that there really wasn't, the standards for mandamus were tough and the standards for granting temporary orders were so broad that it was very hard to prove a clear abuse of discretion. But with the loosening of the mandamus standards and then some of the statutes for temporary orders have been tightened a little bit, it's created a lot more opportunity to seek remedies from the temporary orders, you know, on mandamus.
You know, it's interesting to me from the civil side of things, how much goes on in temporary orders and how much effect that really has on immediate property rights. You know, in the civil case, so often whatever happens in the interim can be remedied by the time you get to the final judgment and all that, but that's not true in family law.
No, I mean, there's so much that happens at temporary orders, which occur, you know, in 2 to 4 weeks after the case is filed without discovery. I mean, you talk about like old school, like shooting from the hip kind of law. That's that's like, go back to the 70s and really try cases. You know, that's how we do it, mostly without discovery or whatever. And, you know, things that happen or the things that are set at that point, you know, kind of dictate how the rest of the case goes on. And that can be problematic.
Seems like just the family code overlay really does add a level of complexity to it. You mentioned the part that had a special rule for findings of fact and conclusions of law. And it seems like you have a lot of quote unquote final orders, which, as Jody was suggesting a moment ago, you know, we don't usually truck along like that. It's the interlocutory appeals under the 52.014 or a mandamus, but it's not, we don't have so many final orders.
Well, we still have the one final judgment rule. It's just that we have multiple proceedings that occur in one cause number. So maybe you start with a divorce, you get a final divorce decree. And then a year later, you file a petition to modify, but that gets filed in the same cause number.
Right.
You get a final order from that. Maybe somebody doesn't pay their child support. You have a petition for enforcement. You get a final order from that. Sometimes enforcements then kind of overlap with the other independent proceedings. So technically, now people mess this up all the time, but technically you then end up with two final orders occurring maybe at the same time, but they're still independent proceedings. And that's kind of one of my pet peeves that I think a lot of times family law judges and lawyers kind of are a little loose with, is that idea of you have an independent petition and then everything that's dependent on that. And sometimes we have two independent proceedings proceeding at the same time in the same cause number, but they should not end up in one judgment. Like, those should be two separate one final judgments, you know, because they're separate appellate remedies. Enforcement is generally either habeas or mandamus, where, you know, a modification or a final divorce would be a direct appeal. So that's another place where you can have kind of that mishmash in family law that y'all just don't see in civil world.
You mentioned your mandamus case briefly in front of the Supreme Court. You were kind of one of the test subjects that had the Zoom arguments earlier this year with the Supreme Court. How did that go?
I mean, I think it went fine. I guess everybody out there can go watch it on YouTube and judge for themselves. You know, we were set right when the shutdown happened. In fact, I filed a motion basically asking the court to hurry up and clarify whether we were going or not, because our offices were all, everybody was in chaos, you know. And so they finally canceled it. Well, then when they decided to reset it in April, I think they gave us like 2.5 weeks notice. And I'm like,
wow,
you know, I wasn't expecting that. Like, I was expecting months. And, you know, I mean, I'm glad. I was disappointed not to be able to go to Austin, because you can't replace the experience of arguing in that big courtroom in Austin with the 9 justices. I mean, it's a great experience. And I really was sad not to get to do that. But, you know, we were the fourth of, I think there were 5 cases that were argued virtually this term. We were the fourth one. So it was very different. I approached it a little bit differently than most of the others. I had a podium. Like, I wanted to kind of recreate this, how you feel when you're in Austin. Like, you're at a podium, they're in front of you, you're standing. Like, you know, I didn't want to be seated for the argument. I feel like that, you know, euphemism of thinking on your feet, like, really is true. And I wanted to be as alert and ready on the ball as I could be for their questions. There's also kind of a lag time, especially with a couple of the justices. I think Wi-Fi connections or something were a little slower. So there was a little bit of lag time and a little bit of, like, I don't know, pixelation or something in the audio. And that made it a little bit difficult. And sometimes the justices would try to ask questions over each other, which happens. I mean, that happens in person also, but the lag time and the audio and, like, everything kind of piled on top of it made it a little more difficult. They had given us each side 5 extra minutes to kind of accommodate for that, which was nice. You know, when you look at the video, you see that I had my camera a little farther back and I had a podium, and you could kind of see me full length, more like you would if I was actually in Austin, you know, when they would record them on TV. And, you know, I, in hindsight, like, was that a good idea? But I don't know. I think everybody's accustomed to seeing, you know, us more like this. But I didn't really feel comfortable with that. I wanted to have a little bit more real world experience. So I don't know. It was unnerving. It was exciting. It was exciting to be one of the few, maybe one of the few ever. I mean, who knows what's going to happen this fall. Mm-hmm. But it was very exciting. You know, unfortunately, they decided the case against my position and reversed a 20-year-old Texas Supreme Court case on mandamus, which I'm not really sure how that works if the trial court followed the existing law, but then they reversed the law on mandamus. I think we may have loosened the mandamus standards a little bit more. And then there's a case that was from 1976 that they've now basically, if not, I don't know that they've quite reversed it, but I think they've distinguished it mostly out of existence on the best interest standard. So, yeah, so it's a huge case. It came out a couple of weeks ago. I don't really agree, obviously, because I argued the other side, but, you know, but what do you do? I mean, we took the case knowing that, I mean, obviously, as appellate lawyers, we know it's a mandamus of temporary orders. And when I got in it at the Supreme Court level, they'd already asked for a response.
Oh.
You know, they hadn't asked for full briefing, but they'd asked for a response. So right there, as appellate lawyers, like, we know somebody up there has decided that this thing needs a really close inspection.
Yep.
And, you know, at the point that they ask for a response on a mandamus, your chances of winning just went, you know. And then when they asked for full briefing, even more. And then when they asked for argument, you're like, okay, my chances of winning this thing have just been reduced to what, 9-10%? You know? So, I mean, we knew going into it that it was likely that they were going to significantly change the existing family law jurisprudence as to non-parent right. But I gave it as good a try as it could have gotten. So we did what we could.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
That's a huge challenge to come into a case. You know, you didn't handle it, anything in the trial court. You didn't handle it in the court of appeals. You come in, the petition's already been prepared and the response has been requested, and in comes Michelle, you know, hopefully to save the day. But as we've seen, the situation there, though, is you've got to work with what you've been given. Not all that unlike what happens when you don't handle anything to do at the trial court and you're taking it, the case up on appeal. But that is a hard job to do. It really is.
It is. And it, I mean, it. We had the State Bar Family Law Section filed an amicus in our favor, and they still ruled against the section. There were 9 amici on the other side. I had to, like, ask some people how to learn how to say that word, by the way, because we never get amicus briefs in family law. But there were 9 right-wing conservative amici briefs filed on the other side of us. One of them's pretty ridiculous. You should go read it. It's quite an interesting little read. But, and so then we had the State Bar Family Law Section file one in our favor, saying basically, how can y'all reverse, you know, 20 years of existing law that the trial court followed on mandamus? Maybe we should wait until final trial is over to, you know, look at this. But they ignored my arguments and they ignored the Miki's arguments too. So,
well, there's nothing like an abuse of discretion being found after the fact, changing the law out from under the trial court.
That's what's right. I mean, they've reversed not only a Supreme Court case, Texas Supreme Court case on point, they reversed at least a handful, if not in final analysis, more than a handful of Court of Appeals cases on point that had interpreted everything. There was one Court of Appeals case, like, square on the facts of this case, and they reversed that. It was a direct precedent. It was out of the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, which is where this case came from, and they reversed that. And I'm still a little puzzled just about how you apply mandamus standard to that. You know, I feel like, again, I feel like in the analysis of this, as we go along and analyze this opinion, I think that we may have seen even a greater loosening of mandamus standard than we've seen, you know, in the past few years. I mean, I think we're kind of at that point where we know a mandamus when we see it, you know?
It seems like the word clear has been dropped from abuse of discretion. It used to be a clear abuse of discretion. And now you kind of look at some of these cases and it's just an abuse of discretion, which may simply be the way that they write the opinion. But I wonder if that's a practical change to the standard.
Yeah. I mean, they still say clear abuse of discretion, but how is a abuse of discretion any different than a clear, I don't know. I mean, and where is the, you know, adequate remedy by appeal? Like, where did that go?
It's all balancing now.
And where is following precedent? Like, if the trial court followed precedent, how did they abuse their discretion, clear or otherwise, clear or unclear? Like, yeah, I feel like we've kind of entered this phase of mandamus where if the court likes the issue or it's interesting, or they don't like the way things have been going on that issue, then all of a sudden it's a clear abuse of discretion that has no adequate remedy at law. I feel like we don't really have a standard anymore.
You know, I remember the fight at the Supreme Court over this 10 or 15 years ago when they started kind of opening mandamus practice up. And it was really a hot fight between all the justices as to how far they were going to let it go. And it felt like we'd kind of reached the high water mark and gone back down, but sounds like it may be kind of moving back in that direction.
And I thought I would at least draw a dissent on that issue, but they issued a unanimous opinion on my case. I mean, you know, so I don't know.
That's interesting.
Well, the issue there too is, and I'm sure you experienced this in your case, is, you know, the Supreme Court, okay, it has the prerogative to change the law if it wants to, although, you know, stare decisis. But at the issue that I wonder if the courts really think about very much is, how are you, Michelle O'Neill, sitting in your office in Dallas, supposed to advise your client on this when, you know, you've got the black letter law that you can show the client and say, this is why we should win. But the other side is arguing, I suppose, for a change in the law, and we just don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, the other side argued that the Supreme Court case, U.S. Supreme Court case of Troxell, overrode basically the Texas Supreme Court case. But Troxell was so vague, and it was a plurality, that, you know, most courts have really been hesitant to go all in on Troxell, you know, but then they did. But yeah, I mean, it's tough to know how to tell a client what to do, you know, and in this particular situation, the 20-year-old case that they reversed, VLK, in VLK, they implored the legislature to address the issue. And the legislature never did. So I think that it kind of was a, you know, hey guys, y'all need to deal with this. And now 20 years later, nobody dealt with it. So they're like, well, fine, we will, you know. If you don't like it, go legislate it.
I was going to say, I guess we'll see some legislation being introduced in the next session.
Yeah.
Addressing this likely.
Yeah, probably. I don't know.
That's interesting.
We're considering whether to file in DC.
Ooh.
I mean, I think if it were a final trial issue, I think that it's square in the middle of some of the dissents in Troxell and some of the opining about the constitutional dimensions of the best interest standard. And so, you know, I wrote a post-submission brief on the constitutional dimensions of the best interest standard as it relates to this issue. And their decision was basically a dismissal of my argument, and they redefined the best interest standard in the opinion. So I think that it puts it square in the middle of Troxell and some of the concerns that were raised in the dissents in Troxell. I just don't know that the Supreme Court in D.C. will take it up on a mandamus. I think that there's just such a tiny little chance anyway of them taking it. But in this situation where it's procedurally not perfect, I don't know that it has a chance of being taken, but I mean, I'm talking to the client about whether he'll authorize us to go ahead and file it. You know, the other side in our case had already said if they lost, they were going to DC. So, But again, I mean, I doubted when they said it, and I doubt it when I say it, that the Supreme Court will get super interested in a mandamus of temporary orders. Mm-hmm. But hey, I didn't think the Texas Supreme Court would be interested in it. So here we are.
You never know.
Yeah.
You know, with all the kind of COVID and stay at home stuff, I've heard some people say that when all this is kind of loosened up and things really do start to open up, that they're anticipating an uptick in family law cases. Have you been seeing that since Texas has kind of opened up a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, you know, divorce work is fairly recession proof anyway. We never saw much of a decline. Maybe I think the courts have kind of said they saw about a 10% decline in hearings and new filings. that might be somewhere close to what we've seen. I mean, we really just haven't experienced much of a decline in business since COVID started. We have seen a definite kind of uptick of business in a weird way. Normally, the summer months, June and July, July especially, are super slow in our cyclical process because everybody goes on vacation in July. They don't really want to get a divorce while the kids are home, you know, start that kind of thing. You know, so usually January and August are our busiest months and it kind of cyclical from there. But this summer, we have not seen that normal kind of downturn in business. Right now, what we're seeing with all the public schools announcing this kind of choice thing of you can choose to do virtual at home or you can choose for your kids to go in person at school. Most everybody that has kids are like, oh, goody, we get a choice. Family lawyers look at that a little bit differently because everybody that we've been divorcing for, you know, the last 5, 8, 10 years has joint custody and shared decision making. And they have joint right to make education decisions. So what happens when one parent thinks we should keep our kids at home and protect them and not go out in public and sure not go around other kids and we're going to homeschool. And the other parent says, you're a terrible homeschooler. We're going to send our kids to school and they can't reach a decision. Guess what that means for family lawyers?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, it means business. Like, so we've already seen the beginnings, the very, very beginnings of litigation over education decisions. And we anticipate, I sent my staff an email last week, you know, kind of educating the first responders of the phone calls that this is coming, the kind of onslaught of dispute is coming. And here's the thing, like, this may be getting too in the weeds of family law, but in a modification, education decisions is one of those decision makings that is kind of in line with primary custody. There's, I won an appeal out of Fort Worth a couple of years ago where they basically put education decisions in line with primary custody decisions. And so it invokes some of the special provisions about the high burden to modify on temporary orders for an education decision. And so there's like a high, probably a higher standard to modify these education decisions, but these people that have shared decision making are, you know, there's a potential of some disagreement. So we do see that coming. There's also the togetherness problem that, you know, if your marriage was on the rocks before COVID or if there were some fissures in the strength of it before COVID, I mean, certainly a lot of togetherness is probably not good for it. And so we still anticipate an uptick in divorces. I don't even think we've seen the beginning of that happening yet.
And so I suppose with that uptick, both on the educational front and on the divorce front, you can probably expect a similar proportionate increase in appellate matters to come out of that.
Yeah, you know, family law appeals are still kind of the stepchild of the appellate world. I mean, a lot of the justices still come from criminal and civil world. You know, having two family lawyers on the Supreme Court has helped that some. But, you know, there's still a little bit of disinterest in family law appeals. So it's not as much as it as I wish it were. But yeah, I mean, there's always potential, especially when you start applying the modification of temporary order standards. That's a place where I have done, and there's been a lot of appeals mandamus done, you know, statewide on judges that misapply that standard. So that's a real hot area. Modification of temporary orders on modification is a hot area in family law appeals, and then non-parent standing custody, all of that is a real hot issue. So that's kind of hitting square in our little hot issues. So we'll see. I'm happy for, you know, anybody who feels like they need a mandamus to call me.
Well, and if you look at today's Texas Supreme Court orders, we're recording this on Friday, July 10th. And the orders that came out today, if you happen to take a peek at them, or look like to me, just from the styles of the cases, that they're loaded with family law cases. Now, these are all denials.
Yeah.
So that fits your observation there, Michelle, about the courts not expressing tons of interest in them. But what I see, though, is just pure volume.
Well, you also have to remember those styles of the case may be CPS cases, and they may also be juvenile cases. So it's not necessarily the style, you know, it could be family law, but it also could be some of the ancillary type family law stuff that, that also gets taken up.
Good point.
Well, Michelle, we want to be respectful of your time, but we always like to let our guests close with either a tip or a war story. Do you have one that you'd like to share with us?
Oh, goodness. A war story. I don't know about that. A tip or a war story. I mean, I think my tip is we've already kind of pretty much covered is, you know, if you're a civil appellate lawyer out there and you get a family law case in your lap, like do your homework or refer it out because, you know, there's several kind of landmines in family law appeals that are out there. And I told you the war story about, you know, the waiver issue, which is all of our worst nightmares, you know, it's also should be the worst nightmare for trial lawyers. But, you know, for an appellate lawyer to have that opinion say, you know, the appellate lawyer didn't do something right is just, So, yeah, I mean, you know, the other issue is the virtual, you know, the virtual arguments. I mean, you know, it's a weird little thing. And we may actually see a resurgence of that in the fall if the pandemic continues. So I would say, you know, in preparation for a virtual argument, you know, test your equipment. I did mine at my office where we had it hardwired into our internet connection so that we weren't on Wi-Fi. We didn't have to worry about, you know, if I'm at home, the lawnmower guy showing up on that very moment at that very day to mow the grass outside, you know, or, you know, Wi-Fi being sketchy or whatever. So, you know, if you're in that situation where you're having to do a virtual argument, you know, I think you need to be hardwired in, test your equipment. I actually ordered, I had a new computer with a new video card installed and got a new camera for that argument because, you know, we were just really on the very beginnings of all the virtual hearings and stuff. And so we were just kind of learning the differences in video, the difference a video card can make. Like, I don't even know what a video card is, but my computer guy's like, well, you're pixelated because your video card isn't great. And I'm like, fix it, you know? So, you know, and then the audio equipment is super important, you know, and that's a place where you can have a lot of echo or vibration or feedback or something that can really affect, you know, all of those little things go to your persuasiveness, right? I mean, and how do you convert what we are normally used to of in-person persuasion in an appellate argument to a virtual setting? And it's the same, but it's different. You know, you aren't necessarily looking them straight in the eyes. You know, it's not, it's just not the same energy, the same experience, you know, so you have to be a little bit different. I mean, I think in my criticism of my argument, I tend to be very focused and, you know, into it. I think I should have smiled more. Like, who thinks of smiling when you're in Austin at the podium? Like, you're not standing there thinking, oh, Michelle, you should look more pleasant, you know? But I was so focused. Like, I think I squint when I'm focused. I'm like, you know, but when you're like this on video, you know, that's a big deal. Like, if you look like you're frowning, you know, that's a big deal in your ability to be persuasive. So, you know, it's little things like that that you don't necessarily think about. I mean, in person, we're thinking about, is our suit ironed? And, you know, and do I have on the right shoes? That's a woman thing. Do I have on the right shoes? Because, you know, Justice Guzman's going to check out my shoes, you know? And plus, I'm known for my shoes with hell on heels, you know? So, you know, those are the things you think about in person and having it all memorized. You know, on virtual, you can have your notes out in front of you. You can look at it. At one point during the argument, they were asking me a question about statute, and I had the statute right there. We're at the podium in Austin. You don't get that desk space, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a little bit different, but I think the equipment, the testing the equipment, the strength of your internet connection, like that can't be replaced. You know, just don't do it on Wi-Fi.
Well, those are all great points, and we really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show and offer some tips. And I'm afraid that what's happened is you've confirmed a lot of my concerns about family law appeals.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's super helpful to have someone who knows kind of explain, look, this is not something that you want to just dabble in. It could be dangerous. And so that's, if folks take nothing else away from this episode than that, I think we would have definitely served our purpose.
We've done a service for sure.
Well, I'm here, you know, if you get one of those, just call me. I've got at least 4 of my 11 lawyers that are experienced in appeals, and we've got varying rates that we charge for varying different experience levels. So we can handle a large variety of appellate work. We don't do the CPS appeals because those are accelerated deadlines and different standards too. Like CPS appeals and termination cases are even a more specialized area. that we don't touch because of the accelerated deadline.
Sure.
But yeah, but family law generally, that's what we do.
Great. Well, before we go, we'd like to pause for just a moment and thank our sponsors, Thomson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. We appreciate their support.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who has rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email, message us on Twitter, or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or on Twitter at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.